Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com.
Like I said before, we'll be in Psalm 57 this evening. Last week we looked at 1 Samuel 22, and 1 Samuel 22 verse 1 begins, David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. So this set in a cave of Adullam. First Samuel 22 explains where he is. The title to Psalm 57 begins with, "To the choir master, according to the Do Not Destroy, a maxim of David, when he fled from Saul in the cave." So here we have a historical account of when this psalm is written. However, Samuel records David fleeing from Saul several times and hiding in a cave. So to pinpoint the exact location, time, historical account when this happens, he flees and hides in a cave in 1 Samuel 24, and then also we have a different dilemma. Psalm 142 begins, "A maskil of David, when he was in the cave, a prayer." So, hard to be able to pinpoint exactly. A lot of historical psalms give us an account, like 56, just before, that when David, the Philistine sees him at Gath. So here we have a little bit of a dilemma. Now, I believe 1 Samuel, Psalm 57 is written in this 1 Samuel 22, and then maybe Psalm 142 is written maybe at the later date in Psalm 24. There's no real rhyme or reason besides just I feel that he fled from Saul is the account that we're good in 57, and this fits in the account when he's fleeing in 1 Samuel 22. But I think the historical context still connects the same, even if you, Psalm 142, could be written when he flees from his son, but we'll just leave it at there. But let's begin by reading the passage this evening from Psalm 57, and we'll go through this together. "Hear now the word Lord. To the choir master, according to Do Not Destroy, a maxim of David, when he fled from Saul in the cave. Be merciful to me, O God, be merciful to me, for in you my soul takes refuge. In the shadow of your wings I will take refuge till the storms of destruction pass by. I cry out to God Most High, to God who fulfills his purpose for me. He will send from heaven and save me. He will put to shame him who tramples on me. God will send out his steadfast love and his faithfulness. My soul is in the midst of lions. Lie down amid fiery beasts, the children of man, whose teeth are spears and arrows, whose tongues are sharp swords. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. They set a net for my steps, my soul was bowed down. They dug a pit in my way, but they have fallen into it themselves. My heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast. I will sing and make melody. Awake, my glory. Awake, O harp and lyre. I will awake the dawn. I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing praises to you among the nations. For your steadfast love is great to the heavens, your faithfulness to the clouds. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth." So here we have Psalm 57. And I think even just reading through that, you start to begin maybe noticing a couple of things that stand out. Verse 5 and verse 11 are the same. They cry out, "Be exalted, O God, above the heavens, and let your glory be over all the earth." They're kind of like this chorus that resounds. You notice the similarities between verse 4 and verse 6, talking about what they've done to him, that they're in lions, they've set their trap. You see verses 2 and 3 and their similarities to verse 7 and 8, "My heart is steadfast, and he who saves me, his steadfast love, his faithfulness, I will give thanks to you and praise you among the nations." And then verse 1 and then 9 and 10, "Be merciful to me, I will give thanks and praise the steadfast love, faithfulness in the clouds." So we'll look at that kind of in those chiasm, that structure of A and A. And so the first thing we notice is the need for deliverance in 4 and 6. That in this title, it says when he fled from Saul, important part as we've been looking at this, he's been chased down again and again, continually running. We notice Psalm 22, Psalm 23, Psalm 24 is basically this progression where he cannot find a home, cannot find any rest. And now Saul has not only tried to kill David on several occasions and also his son Jonathan, but following chapter 22, he's actually committed murder based on this envy, wiping out other people. Next week, we'll look at Psalm 52 with the Doeg. But he wipes out the whole house of Ahimelech except Abiathar. And it's almost like the waters have begun to rise. The threat becomes more real. Not only the threat is against David, but anyone who associates himself with David is there. And people have lost their lives because of this envy which happens in the heart of Saul towards David. And this reality is not seeming that it's going to pass. And out of the prayers or the amount of time that we look at in this psalm, you would think that David would spend all his time imploring God, which he does, to save him. But only really a small sliver of this psalm is dedicated to David praying for this deliverance. And that's what I think a maktim is, this last cry for help. But he doesn't even mention Saul once besides in the title. His prayer request turns to praise. It turns to a praise report more often than not. He only mentions his enemies in two verses, verses 4 and 6. You would think if we were coming in this situation and praying to God in a cave, been chased down by Saul, this would be what most of our prayer would be shaped like. But he prays in verse 4 that his soul is in the midst of lions. "I lie down amid fiery beasts and the children of man whose teeth are spears and arrows, whose tongues are sharp swords." Two things that we see in this verse, in verse 4, is surrounded. First, that he's surrounded by fiery beasts and lions. And the second, their teeth and their tongues. The metaphor of lions and fiery beasts, and then showing their teeth. But they're lions who have spears and arrows. Their tongues are swords, they say. Now, what a contrast that is to Psalm 23, as we well know. "He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me by still waters." Here, he's not lying down in green pastures. He hasn't found a place of rest. He's surrounded by lions, by fiery beasts. And verse 6 explains what they're trying to do, that they're setting their nets, a net for my steps. "And my soul has bowed down. They have dug a pit in my way." That here, they set traps trying to ensnare him, trying to capture him. But they eventually just fall into them themselves. Verse 1 explains that David calls this moment in his life a storm of destruction. This is what he's waiting for them to pass by. The analogy has grown. No longer they're howling dogs outside of his house, as we've looked at, but they're fierce lions who have set their snares, set their traps to try and capture him. But in this moment, this storm of destruction is around. It doesn't look like the storm, there's any glimmer of hope. There's no light on the horizon. It doesn't look like it's moving away, but it's set in, this storm of destruction. And the storm had finally set in. There's no sign of a blue sky, no glimpse of a ray of sunshine. We often see the effects after the storm, but hardly ever do we think and consider the storm in amongst it. When you're in the midst of a storm, you only think of its power, its destruction. You hope to get to the other side, but you're really just hoping just to get to the other side. You don't think about what it's going to be like to have to clean up all the mess, the rubbish, the potential to destroy, but also your frailty of yourself when you think of a storm and the power. Now, in my life, I've had a rare glimpse, really, I haven't seen a destructive storm in that real sense. Australia has hail storms, it has bushfires and floods, but not really where I was. The hail storms would do some damage, but if you were inside, it really wouldn't do a lot of damage. In North Carolina, we would have ice storms that would pass through, maybe a small tornado, but often the thing that would really keep me up at night was strong winds. I would lie awake at night and hear the strong wind howl in the trees that were located very close to our house. And when the wind becomes loud, you really hear the effects of what it can do, and you think about what you've seen it do in the past. We'd go on walks through places and tall trees, you know, I couldn't fit my arms around the trunk, and they'd be toppled over with their roots 10 foot high in the air. You know, they'd just been blown over by the wind. You really think as wind is a silent thing, but wind in the midst of a storm is a loud thing. You hear the effects of it. You hear and see the wind. But here, the laying awake at night, just thinking about these tall trees that located, and if any one of them was to topple over or a branch was to fall, you know, who would it crush? Who would it take over? Now, I've survived all these storms, obviously. However, in the middle of the storm, you're only thinking about one thing. Will I make it? You don't think about your plans for tomorrow, what I'm going to be eating for lunch when you're lying awake at night. What I need to get from the store, you're just hoping and praying that you will make it to tomorrow. And now David has run to several places, and the path of destruction follows him. And it seems that death only follows him and even gets closer. And his situation continues to move that way. In David's situation, the storm does not look like it's passing anytime soon. The enemy who desires to see him dead, and also has the means to be able to carry this out, is on his tail, pursuing him. Yet you would think this is what would take up his mind when he writes this psalm. You think that this is what he would be praying about, what would be consuming him. However, his focus is not on the storm or Saul, but on God in amongst this storm of destruction. The second thing we see is his relationship to God. Verse 2 and 3 explains, I cry out to God Most High, to the God who fulfills his purpose for me. He will send me from heaven and send from heaven and save me. He will put to shame him who tramples on me. His cry is not to the storm, but to the God Most High. The Hebrew, the God Most High, is Elohim Elon. And Elon is used in Genesis 14 of Melchizedek, the priest of the God Most High, the possessor of heaven and earth. His cry is to the God who is above the storm. In this name Elon, God is to be acknowledged as incomparable, the exalted, the maker, possessor, the ruler of all people, things, and all events. This is believed term Elyon is derived from the verb Allah, meaning to go up, to be elevated, to be exalted. And this is who he is praying to, the exalted God. Higher than the storm, higher than Saul, higher than this problem which he cries out. And we'll see this when we get to the chorus, his exalted God in which he prays. But he cries out to the God Most High, the possessor of heaven and earth, the God Most High who fulfills his promise, purpose to me. Literally in the Hebrew, he fulfills his purpose. It's God's purpose, God's goals, God's telos, his chief end. The ruler of all people, all things, all events. And this is the God in which he prays. This is the God who fulfills his purpose to him, the exalted maker and possessor of heaven and earth. This, we know this verse very well, Jeremiah 29:11. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope. But then, verse 12 and 13, then you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will hear you, and you will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. And this is who David in this cave cries out to. He knows the plans, he knows his purpose, and he cries out to him. For him, God, to deliver him, the God Most High who fulfills his purpose by sending from heaven and saving him. Verse 3 really gives us a great glimpse of the gospel when he says he will send from heaven and save me. He will put to shame him who tramples on me. Matthew Henry says, whatever good God performs concerning his people, it will appear in the issue to have been performed for them and for their benefit. Though God be high, most high, yet he condescends so low as to take care of all things, be made to work good for them. God voluntarily condescends to redeem us from sin and Satan, although we might be trampled. It is Satan who will be crushed. And this is God Most High, the one who comes down. He will send from heaven to save me. The length, the extent in which God will do to come and save us, he will indeed be sent from heaven. And then verse 7. My heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast. I will sing and make melody. Awake, my glory. Awake, O harp and lyre. I will awake the dawn. Because God has sent out his steadfast love, David's heart is now steadfast. Although surrounded by lions and fiery beasts, the situation hasn't changed. The storm of destruction is still surrounding him. Yet David sees God is far above the storm. Not only is it far above the storm, he has a plan and a purpose in which he will fulfill. He will send from heaven to be able to save him from this situation he finds himself. He will crush the enemy. He will put to shame him who tramples on me. God will send his steadfast love and his faithfulness. Thirdly, we see an appeal to mercy in his praise in verses 1 and then 9 and 10. Verse 1 says, be merciful to me, O God, be merciful to me. For in you my soul takes refuge. In the shadow of your wings, I will take refuge till the storms of destruction pass by. David's cry will be echoed by the tax collector who prays in the temple, far off, beating his breast, lifting his eyes to heaven, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. that this man went home justified rather than the Pharisee. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but he who humbles himself will be exalted. The one who asks for mercy is the one who needs mercy given to him. You don't ask for mercy. No one chooses to be a beggar just because they dream job is a beggar. They beg because they have a need. And here David begs for mercy to be given to him because he realizes mercy needs to be given him to him. David cries out for mercy, and mercy not from his enemies, but from God. He runs to God for mercy in this horrible situation that he finds himself in. He sits in the cave of Adullam, trying to avoid physical harm, trying to hide, to escape. And yet his soul seeks to take refuge under the merciful wings of God. And he writes, "In the shadow of your wings." And this has beautiful connotations when we think about the mercy seat. Under the shadow of your wings is a beautiful image of a mother bird protecting their chicks. But even more so, when we think about the tabernacle, that David knows this image well, the Ark of the Covenant. And he writes, "Under the shadow of your wings that I will take refuge." Psalm 17:8 says, "Keep me as the apple of your eye, and hide me in the shadow of your wings." Psalm 91:1, "He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty." Or verse 4, "He will cover you with his pinions, and under his wings you will find refuge. His faithfulness is a shield and a buckler." This beautiful image of God, the location where God is close to his people, where the mercy seat, where mercy is shown, where blood is sprinkled. The high priest go and intercede for his people. This mercy seat, explained in Exodus 25, explains what they're to do. The two cherubim of gold, the hammered work, you make them the ends of mercy seat. One cherubim on one end, one on the other end. One with a piece of mercy seat, you shall make the cherubim on its two ends. And it shall spread their wings above, overshadowing the mercy seat with their wings, faces to another. Towards the mercy seat shall the faces of the cherubim be. And here, on top of the ark, where God's presence is symbolized, the testimony of God's good graces which he has shown to them. This is underneath his shadow of the wings, I will take refuge. What an image of beauty. The mercy seat is where God would meet them, Exodus 25:22 says. God would speak to them, verse 22. But also the image of atonement was also there as well. Tyndale actually called this the atonement cover. Leviticus 16, it explains that he shall come and take the blood of the bull and sprinkle it on his finger in front of the mercy seat on the east side. In the front of the mercy seat, he shall sprinkle some of the blood with his finger seven times. Even in Hebrews, Verse 5 and 11. "Above it, the cherubim of the glory overshadowing the mercy seat. Of these things we cannot now speak in detail." Sometimes you just wish you could stop and say, could you, by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, write just a little bit more on this? Go into detail about the mercy seat. But obviously the Holy Spirit didn't inspire them to do that. But these preparations having thus been made, the priests go regularly into the first section performing their ritual duties. But into the second only the high priest goes, but once a year, and without taking blood, which he offers for himself and the unintentional sins of the people. Here, to be underneath the wings, to take refuge in God. What a great image that is. To be back, not in a cave, damp and cold, with a storm surrounding, but to be back in the house of the Lord, to be back with Him, where He speaks to you. But also that great image of Christ. Christ coming as the great high priest. Though the greater, the more perfect tent, not made with hands and not in this creation. He entered once for all into the holy places. Not with the blood of bulls and goats and calves, but by His own blood, thus securing eternal redemption. By the bulls and goats, sprinkling of defiled persons in the ashes of the heifer, sanctify the purification of the flesh. How much more will the blood of Christ, through the eternal Spirit, offered Himself without blemish, purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God. And David pleads in this psalm to be underneath the shadow of God's wings. He will find refuge, not in the image of a mother bird protecting her chicks, but more importantly of being in the Holy of Holies. The image of the blood-covered ark that has sprinkle splatters over it, where mercy is to be found. And David asks for mercy, and David turns to God, the Most High. Again, I love this psalm because these words are often printed on nice art or Instagram posts, put with nice images, and we think they're good. Yet we often don't necessarily think about the occasion in which they're written. We think that many of these psalms are written on a mountaintop as the sun begins to peek its head over the horizon and the dawn of a new day beckons. Yet this psalm is not written in the crisp air, but in a cave of despair. This psalm is written, I believe, right at the start of 1 Samuel 22. After fleeing Saul and going to Nob and then to Gath and acting like a madman and running. The psalm, I believe, is written in verse 1 of Psalm 22. And David is alone. His family has not yet come. And previously he is surrounded by prowling dogs in Psalm 59, but now it's lions. You think Psalm 59 is bad. I think Psalm 57 is a lower point in his life. But even in this cave in which he's hiding, David is able to see past the cave, past Saul, past the storm, past the lions which surround him. And he's able to cry out the great chorus in verses 5 and 11. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. Twice he sings this. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. David is able to know about his enemies. And he cries out to God for him to deliver him. He thinks of his relationship to God, but also God's mercy. And he's able to see above the dark cave, higher than his enemies. He's able to see the God Most High, Elyon, the one who is above the heavens, whose glory would be over all the earth. Now, there's a hymn called Under His Wings by William Cushing. And as far as I know, you've sang this twice, March 15th, 2009 and March 6th, 2011. And this hymn says, "Under His wings I am safely abiding through the night deep, though the night deepens and the tempests are wild. Still I can trust Him. I know He will keep me. He has rendered to me and I am His child. Under His wings, what a refuge in sorrow. How the heart yearning turns to His rest. Often when life has no balm for my healing, then I find comfort, and there I am blessed. Under His wings, what a precious enjoyment. There I hide till life's trials are o'er. Sheltered, protected, no evil can harm me. Resting in Jesus, I am safe evermore." To think about being under the wings of God. The God Most High, the possessor, the maker of heaven and earth. That image of the mercy seat, where God meets His people and shows grace to His people. And to be under His wings is not merely just a small little chick underneath the mother hen, but underneath the Almighty God, the possessor of heaven and earth, the God Most High. What a glorious thought that is, that even in amongst this dark, damp, depressing cave, David can cry out, "Be exalted, O God, above the heavens, and let Your glory be over all the earth." Think about being stuck in a cave and being able to think about God's glory is above all the earth, that He would be exalted. What a great cry that is for us when we are in those similar situations. To pray for deliverance, yes. Tell God of our sorrows, our woes, the fires, the lions that surround us, the fiery beasts that are about us, the people who set traps for us. But just not to focus on those things, but to shift our gaze and our glance towards God, the Almighty One, possessor of heaven and earth. Because that damp, dark, depressing cave is just but for a moment, as David cries out in verse 1, until the storms of destruction pass by. The storm might look to be set in David's life, but he is able to set his gaze to the heavens, to be able to look forward to that time where that storm does indeed pass by, where maybe once again he might be able to gaze upon that mercy seat as the image of where God meets His people, that image of where God speaks to His people.
Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com. Seven Springs Presbyterian Church began in 1874 and is a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America located in Glade Spring, Virginia. Please join us for worship on Sunday at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. for His glory and His gospel.